Okay, also on the panel today are Judges Jessen and Sleater. I believe they can see both counsel and hear both counsel. And Mr. Wilson, are you ready to proceed as well?
I am, Judge, thank you.
Okay, very good. We will go ahead and proceed with the next case on our calendar today, which is A20-0536, Megan Ashley Spindler versus Donald Lee Westman. Excuse me. This oral argument is being held by Zoom in accordance with court-related pandemic orders or pandemic-related court orders, rather. We'll follow the standard procedures. Each party will have 15 minutes for their initial argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording this oral argument, and I'll just remind anyone who's watching that recordings of the oral argument are not allowed without permission of the prior permission of the Court of Appeals, but the Court of Appeals is recording the argument. And to ensure we have a good recording of the argument, I'll ask that both counsel identify themselves and the party they represent at the beginning of their oral argument. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning again. I'm Rick Stemple. I'm the attorney for appellant Donald Westman. And may it please the court and counsel for the respondent. This is an appeal from a jury trial in the Anoka County District Court in October of 2019. And the appeal is based on what we allege is misconduct in the closing argument of plaintiff's counsel. There were post-trial motions duly made, and in the order that the trial court entered on February 5th, 2020, it was found that there were statements made in closing by the counsel for plaintiff that differed from what I, as the defense counsel, told the jury, that those statements by plaintiff's counsel mischaracterized what defense counsel had told the jury, and then concluded that those misrepresentations did not equate to misconduct because the comments focused on the opinions of defense counsel, which is not evidence and therefore could not be misconduct. And I submit to the panel that intentionally misrepresenting or mischaracterizing the comments made by opposing counsel are in fact misconduct because
Mr. Stemple, could I interrupt you just preliminarily before you continue to clarify a point that I think was raised in the motion to strike? Is it true that you're not asking us to review the district court's decision on the in limine motion to limit the defense doctor's testimony to the IME? I just wanted to clarify that.
Good morning, Judge Sleater. No, I'm not asking for that. I'm asking for a ruling by the panel that it was an error of law in the legal analysis of what the plaintiff's counsel stated in closing argument.
Very good. Thank you. Appreciate that.
And good to see you again, Judge. It's been a number of years.
Thank you.
If I may, the analysis by the trial court was that because the mischaracterization and misrepresentations of what defense counsel argued in the closing argument went to defense counsel's opinions and beliefs and not the evidence, that there could be no misconduct. And on behalf of my client, Donald Westman, I submit to the panel that this is in fact misconduct. It deprived my client of a fair trial and denied him due process in the sense that the closing arguments are for the attorneys to comment on evidence. And the remarks that are at the heart of this are telling the jury that I believe the damages were $3 million, that I was agreeing with that. And the record clearly shows that is not the case.
Mr. Stemple, if I may.
Yes. Good morning, Judge.
Good morning. And back to your point that that this was misconduct. So what case can you point us to that demonstrates the closest to demonstrating that this is misconduct as opposed to, as the district court said, just a misstatement of counsel's opinion? Help us out here.
Well, I'm relying primarily on Wild versus Rarig, Your Honor, the Minnesota Supreme Court case. And we've cited the other cases that we're relying on in our brief and the rules. Okay, it looks like you want to ask me something. Go ahead.
You cite a lot of cases in your brief. What's the case that we should look at that's most closely going to say that this misstatement was misconduct?
I would say Wild versus Rarig, Your Honor. I think that's the controlling case here. And I'd ask that you rely on that. And based on what we have set forth in our brief as controlling authorities, it is misconduct to misrepresent. And it had to be intentional, Your Honor, because counsel knew what I actually said, got up and said something that was a gross distortion of what I said, and represented to the jury that I actually agreed with their damage figure. And further statements were made to the effect that I didn't believe in my case and I didn't believe my own doctor. And you have to ask it, at least in my opinion, Your Honor, why would somebody argue that on closing? They know that's not true, yet they argued it. There can really only be a couple of reasons for that. It was a deliberate act. It was done to outrage or upset the jury. And it was grossly unfair to Donald Westman, my client. And so we have a case where I think the trial court looked at it as, hey, they're asking for $5 million plus, and the award is only $1 million, so it didn't affect it. We don't know that, Your Honor. What I argued was for a future award of $0. That's clear in the record. And
Mr.
yet
Stemple,
it's represented to the jury after I've already made my closing argument and have no chance to speak to the misrepresentations to the jury that I was in fact agreeing with it, that I didn't believe in my case, and that I didn't believe my own doctor. And
Mr.
so
Stemple, could I
rise to that level, Your Honor, of Wild versus Rarig, that certain conduct is so egregious, it's unfair and prejudicial to the opposing party.
Mr.
So
Stemple,
what you're stressing here?
The Wild case also refers to or it has the language that we've seen, of course, in a plethora of cases, that if a curative instruction is provided, a new trial is rarely granted. And in this case, of course, as I understand it, the curative instruction was provided and actually was recommended by you. How do we, in that scenario, then what makes this the rare case that a new trial should have been granted?
What the question that was posed to me when I was frozen out?
Mr. Stemple, this is Judge Sleater. I was actually following up with Judge Jessen's question, and you referenced the Rarig case, and that case also recites what we know to be a plethora of cases that direct our review, and that is that when a curative instruction is given, a new trial, that's what that court said, would be very rare. And of course, in here, the curative instruction, as I understand it, was actually presented by you to the judge, who accepted it and read it to the jury. And so what would you point to in this case that would make it the rare situation that a new trial should have been granted?
Well, here's what I'd point to, Judge Sleater. Those comments were so over the top and so misrepresented what I said, and I did wait. I felt opposing counsel was almost at the conclusion of the argument, and I objected immediately upon conclusion, and we had a sidebar with the trial court, and I made my objection there, and then it was posed to me to come up with a curative instruction on the spot. And given the magnitude of the misrepresentations of what I said, Your Honor, I think it was prejudicial to Donald Westman to have to, in the heat of a jury trial, come up with a good curative instruction on the spot. The other thing, I think, from the analysis of the trial court's order, if you look at pages 12 through 14 of the trial court's order,
The mischaracterization and misrepresentation of what I said and what I believe are not even misconduct. So I don't know what kind of curative instruction the trial court would have agreed to when the belief was opposing counsel didn't do anything wrong. And so I do think that makes this one of those rare cases under Wild versus Rarig, to answer your question, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Stemple. How do we overcome then the jury verdict, which obviously was at least reduced by more than two thirds, perhaps, of what the plaintiff respondent had been asking for in order to find a prejudice?
Well, to answer, and that's a good question, Your Honor. I think the trial court stated that the actual claim was for over $5 million. So if you look at it that way, I guess I did a great job. I don't feel that way, given the way the closing arguments went. What we asked for in the post-trial motions is what I'd asked for here, Your Honor, a new trial on the future damages. That's where the misconduct had its effect and prejudiced my client. We had stipulated to what the dollar value of the medical expenses to date were. And if you review my closing argument, the numbers that the jury awarded for past damages were very much in line with my argument. Where it diverges is when the jury awards $470,000 for future medical and $470,000 for future pain and suffering, when the defense argument was there should be a zero award for those. So if you look at it from the defense perspective, that $940,000 is a huge difference based on what was actually argued to the jury. So the remedy would be for a new trial on future damages, Your Honor.
Mr. Stemple, this is Judge Cochran. I have a question for you on the issue of waiver. Would you agree that the only statement that was objected to was the one that relating to what defense counsel thought in terms of the damage amounts, and the other statements that you're challenging on appeal here were not specifically objected to?
I would dispute that, Honor, and here's why. When we went for the sidebar, when I was making my objection, and I was asked to provide an immediate curative instruction, the background noise or haze to keep the jury from hearing what was said, being said at the sidebar, was placed on. And my understanding was we're on the record. We apparently weren't. I found out later we weren't. Therefore, there's no record of my objection at that time. But the objection went to everything that was being said that we're contesting, because it was all a mischaracterization to say I didn't believe in my own case or believe what my own doctor testified to, and that I thought the damages were $3 million. I mean, it was represented to this jury. I agreed that that's what the damages were. So I do disagree with that respectfully for that reason. Your Honor, since I can't see, could one of you let me know how much time I have left, please?
Certainly. You have 2 minutes and 42 seconds left, Mr. Stemple.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I would like the panel to focus on the legal analysis of the trial court, because it really creates a situation where an attorney, as an officer of the court, can say anything about what his opponent just said, no matter how much it's misrepresented, or comment on the other attorney's beliefs. And I do not believe that comports with our rules of civil procedure, our rules of professional conduct. And given that, it would be fair to give Mr. Westman a new trial on the future damages. What we're really contesting at the heart of it is the trial court's legal analysis of what occurred. And to that extent, I'm just going to opine that I don't think it would matter, no matter how many objections I made or logged in the trial court's opinion, none of it was objectionable, none of it was misconduct. And as a trial attorney, you have to weigh out the here and now in a trial setting. Do I object a number of times, possibly upsetting the court and jury? Is it a lack of professional courtesy to your opposing counsel to interrupt time and time again? And that's why I waited till the conclusion of the argument and made my objections. Unfortunately, we were not on the record. I thought we were because of the background noise being on with the jury still in the courtroom. But the jury wasn't even dismissed from the courtroom when I was asked to make the curative instruction. So to come up with it. And I don't think the curative instruction would have mattered once that horse was out of the barn, quite frankly. It's a gross mischaracterization of what I said. It was wrongful and it had to be intentional because counsel was there and heard what I actually said. And the trial court agreed that it was a mischaracterization and a misrepresentation of what was said by defense counsel. So with that, I would ask that you grant Mr. Westman a new trial as argued here today. And I don't know if I have time. Again, I apologize that I can't see.
Well, Mr. Stempel, your timing's perfect. The 15 minutes just ended and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, you can proceed when you're ready for respondent.
Thank you, Judge. Well, good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Scott Wilson, and together with Nate Bierke and Lance Rendlinger, who are both with us today, I represent respondent Megan Spindler. The right result in this case is controlled by two principles. One of which the court touched on during opposing counsel's argument. The first principle is waiver. The second principle, which we didn't really touch on, is judicial discretion. And I want to talk about them both briefly. First of all, I want to be clear on this footing. Waiver is not a technical issue. It's not a small thing. When a party fails to object to improper closing argument, the district court loses the opportunity to rule at the right time. And that's before the jury is excused to deliberate while a corrective instruction can be given. When a party expressly waives an issue, which actually happened here as to one of the issues that's being argued before you in the briefs, that party is telling the district court not to reach the issue. So the party is affirmatively destroying the district court's opportunity to rule. Those aren't technical concerns. But the issue we haven't touched on yet this morning is judicial discretion. And judicial discretion matters. Judge Sleater, you were a district court judge for many years in Renville County. The complex and highly subjective undertaking of a jury trial can't be fairly administered unless we grant a significant amount of discretion to the trial judge. And the district court's discretion, it reaches its highest level here, really, where there are accusations of misconduct in closing argument. And that's because only the district court has got the full picture. Here's what the Minnesota Supreme Court.
Can I just take you back to your first point?
Sure.
And you referenced my experience on the district court bench. And I, part of what Mr. Stempel raised is a good point, because attorneys would find it somehow it was to be interrupted multiple times during a closing statement. And frankly, as a judge, I didn't care for it too much either. And yet here, there was the bench conference. And would it have been more appropriate in this case, given the significance of the objection, even to the one issue or the one statement that was made, to have perhaps recessed the jury and allow a full airing of the objections that would have been made at that point? Would that have been appropriate discretion, in other words, for a judge to exercise?
I think there's a couple of issues raised in your question, as I hear it, Judge. The first is you don't want multiple interruptions in closing argument. And I agree with that. Actually, you don't want any interruptions in closing argument. And really, I think you and I both know the appropriate time to object is at the end of your opponent's closing, which is what Mr. Stemple did. But your next question is about making a record outside the presence of the jury. And my recollection, I've got a check, and I would invite the court to check, but my recollection is that Mr. Stemple actually had two opportunities to object. The first was immediately after closing, while the jury was still present, and while I assume the white noise was being played so that the jury wouldn't hear him. The second opportunity was before the jury retired. At that point, my recollection of the record is that Judge Brown asked counsel if they were satisfied with the curative instruction. And both of them were either silent or said that they were, and then the jury was allowed to retire. And at that point, it was no longer appropriate to raise further objections or to ask for further curative instructions. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, let me go back to judicial discretion. I actually just wanted to, since I've made this assertion that it reaches its zenith here when we're looking at the trial court's handling of alleged misconduct in closing argument, I want to share a couple of quotes with you from the Supreme Court. These are both in our briefs, but they're worth looking at specifically. In Fisher versus Mart, 1976, the Minnesota Supreme Court said, since the trial judge was present when the improper argument was made and could observe its impact on the jury, the trial court's determination is generally entitled to deference absent clear abuse of discretion. And then in 1953, the court actually made a stronger statement in Maher versus Reusner. What the court said there, and I think the flavor of this is shot throughout our state's jurisprudence on this question. The determination of whether or not the misconduct of counsel warrants a new trial rests almost entirely in the discretion of the trial judge. So you take those two principles, waiver and judicial discretion, and you apply them to this case. I assert that what you see is that, first of all but one of appellant's arguments that have been briefed to you were waived, either affirmatively or by failure to timely object and request curative instruction. The remaining argument, which goes to our statement in closing argument that the defense counsel agreed with our assessment of future damages, was decided correctly within the district court's discretion. No misconduct and no prejudice. So I want to briefly address waiver. And before I do, I just want to point to the work that Judge Brown did in this case. You're looking at a 34-page district court order. And if you haven't done so, I would invite you to read the transcript of the post-trial hearing. That's not always a central piece, but here I think it is. Judge Brown perceived that there was what she expressly referred to as a pattern of failure to object on the part of defense counsel. And she addressed that by studying the post-trial motions and showing up at the post-trial hearing. And then she very carefully and thoroughly questioned Mr. Stemple as to what arguments he was making and what arguments he was not making. In the course of that, he expressly waived his argument about Mr. Bierke's statement that Mr. Stemple was just saying that Megan Spindler didn't have CRPS when he knows that she does. So that was actually expressly waived. The rest of the arguments, other than the mischaracterization of the future damages argument, were all waived by failure to timely object and request curative instruction. And now that's important. And the transcript of the post-trial hearing is important because Mr. Stemple has told you that when he stood up immediately after Mr. Bierke's argument and the white noise was going, the jury was present in the room and he had his opportunity to speak to the judge, that he objected to other aspects of the argument. That is not what he said in response to Judge Brown's close questioning in the post-trial motion hearing. Instead, he confirmed that there was no objection to each of these additional points. So my point about that is that Judge Brown was very careful to narrow the issues before her. She successfully narrowed them based on what Mr. Stemple confirmed to her at the post-trial motion hearing. And this court's review should be narrowed in the same way. You should only consider arguments concerning mischaracterization of Mr. Stemple's argument on future damages. Now, having addressed waiver, let me move to Judge Brown's exercise of discretion. There are two general principles in play here with respect to her decision, I would assert. The first is that context is king. I already touched on this. She had the full context of the trial. She saw the evidence come in. She listened to the arguments live. She watched the impact on the jury. And I want to be honest with you. What happened here was by no means perfect. Mr. Bierke, first of all, gave a bare-knuckled closing argument in this case. The thing about that is that the district court understood his argument as bare-knuckled as it was. It understood that argument as an appropriate response to an aggressive, high-risk, counterfactual defense strategy, which was to make our client, Megan Spindler, out to be a liar about whether or not she had CRPS in the face of unanimous medical evidence that she did have the condition. And this court should defer to the district court's perception that our argument was, in that context, overall appropriate because she had the feel of the trial. The second general principle is just prejudice. Minnesota courts have said over and over, and we cataloged some of the cases for you in our brief at page 27, our courts have said over and over that the primary consideration in any determination of new trial with respect to misconduct of counsel in closing argument is prejudice. So let me turn
one of the statements that I know you contend was waived is one I'd like to focus on in terms of prejudice. So, you know, assuming it can be considered, the statement that the doctor never says she doesn't have CRPS because she does. Even Dr. Bargerino, maybe I mispronounced that, knows that she does. How is that statement consistent with the record?
That statement is consistent with the evidence. It is not consistent with the full record, including the excluded testimony by Dr. Bargerino, where he said the opposite from what Mr. Bierke said.
Well, how is it even consistent with the evidence at trial? Because there wasn't any evidence that the doctor knew she had CRPS. He didn't testify to that, correct?
No, he didn't testify to that. I think it leaves us with a question that I want to address very simply. When I first read this record, when this case was brought to me as appellate counsel, and I read the record, I was uncomfortable with Mr. Bierke's statement about that because Dr. Bargerino has said the opposite in excluded testimony. And I've also thought about what you just said, Judge, which is that there's a vacuum in the record. What I would say about it is that Mr. Bierke did not say what he said perfectly. He was pushing back hard on the defense argument that our client was a liar, despite the fact that all of the admitted evidence said that she wasn't a liar. And I think he spoke clumsily, and I think he would admit that to you if he was speaking to you right now. What the district court saw, however, was that in the full context of the trial, here's what Mr. Bierke was saying with respect to both opposing counsel's view of CRPS and Dr. Bergerino's view of CRPS. And he said in two different waived arguments, or the subject of two different waived arguments, he said that both of them knew that she had CRPS and they were just saying that she didn't. What he was saying to the jury was, they know better. How could they not know that she has CRPS given the evidence? And this is the important piece, Judge, that is how the district court heard the statement. What the district court said about this, despite what you and I have both acknowledged about its inconsistency with Dr. Bergerino's testimony and maybe even the vacuum in the evidence, what the district court said was plaintiff's attorney did not commit misconduct or suggest defense counsel lied. That's in the addendum at page 38. She instead saw the comment as appropriate, as an appropriate response to the defense position that his client was lying. What the district court said was, quote, when read in full context, the point the attorney seems to be making is that everyone, parentheses, including defense counsel, close parentheses, should recognize that the evidence supports a finding that plaintiff has CRPS. That's also at addendum page 38. That statement is important, and I would assert in good faith to you, Judge, however uncomfortable you and I may be with that statement by Mr. Bjerke, that that statement is entitled to deference. It's from Mr. the Wilson, judge who I understood the entire trial.
Follow up a little bit with Judge Cochran's question, that how do we not look at that and the other statements that I assume respondent does not dispute was false? So for instance, the statement regarding, you combine that with one that appellant most concerned about was the agreement, the perceived agreement. It was clearly was no agreement regarding the damages. So you combine that with a belief that the defense expert telling the jury that a defense expert agrees with the diagnosis when in fact counsel knows that he does not. Should not the court review all of that? And it leads to my broader question. Do you see a distinction between a false statement and misconduct in terms of how a trial judge and how we review a motion for new trial should be?
Okay, I heard two questions. The first is, should we not review all of that? And it won't surprise you to hear that my answer is no, but actually no, you shouldn't. Because as I said at the beginning of this argument, waiver matters. And the first of those additional statements, the statement about what opposing counsel believed about CRPS, that was affirmatively waived, expressly waived in district court. You really can't review that. I mean, you can, you're the judge, but I hope that you would not. The second part of your question, and I'm blinking red here. Can I finish my answer?
You're smiling. Yes, I'm unmuted. Yes, you may. Please go ahead.
All right. I appreciate it. The second part of your question is there a distinction between something that's not true and misconduct? And I would say absolutely there is. And that was the line of Judge Brown's reasoning as the district judge. You have to understand that all of these comments are being made in the heat of battle. There's jurisprudence in the state that acknowledges the trials never come in perfectly. And closing arguments are never perfect. So yes, there has to be a difference between a statement in closing argument, which is not evidence, that's not true, and misconduct. And Judge Brown exercised her broad discretion to determine that these statements, while some of them were untrue, weren't misconduct, and moreover, were not prejudicial. That's my answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your arguments, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Stemple, are you able to hear me?
I am, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
I can. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you can start when you're ready, sir.
I am ready, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to start with some of Respondent's Counsel's closing remarks in his argument. He likened the respondent's trial attorney's closing to a bare-knuckle brawl, essentially. And I would submit to you that while trials may be heated, there might be opposing views, we're supposed to have rules of professional conduct, and we're supposed to do ultimately what's right as officers of the court. It's not a bare-knuckle event. We don't take hockey gloves into the courtroom and drop them in front of the jury and hit each other. So to say, well, it was that way, but it's okay, seems to be missing a significant point about the professionalism and ethics of counsel and saying something they know is wrong and misstates the facts. And I go back to, why would you say that when you know it's not true? Well, I don't know if the panel's aware. There was significant surveillance footage of the plaintiff doing extensive weightlifting, bodybuilding, her own social media post at a bodybuilders contest. There's a lot of evidence that cut against the claims. Dr. Roddy from Sister Kenny Institute and Dr. Evans from Duran Clinic, both, Dr. Roddy discharged the plaintiff from care. And Dr. Evans basically said, there's nothing I can do for you. I can't see the CRPS. No one ever saw this alleged condition. Yet it's okay to go bare knuckle and not say something perfectly, even if it's prejudicial to the defendant. I think not. And so I'd really ask the court to consider everything. Sometimes, and Judge Sleater was a trial judge for many years. I'm sure he's well aware. Sometimes it's a little bit more laborious for one of the attorneys in the courtroom. They're outnumbered. They have different things going on. And to bring up, to go back to Judge Sleater's point about Dr. Bergarino, I was told during the trial, I would have to bring him live in literally less than 48 hours, which was not possible because of a ruling by the trial court. And yet, knowing that was safely done, opposing counsel misrepresented to the jury what Dr. Bergarino actually thought about the plaintiff's condition. So I just disagree with the respondent's arguments here. And really, the whole waiver argument, in light of everything, is a distraction from the real issue. And the real issue is, can an attorney, as an officer of the court, make statements and representations which are known to not be accurate and not be true, and that's okay. And I get it that we give the trial court discretion. But that's why we have the Court of Appeals, because sometimes errors are made, errors in the legal analysis, errors in that discretion. Yes.
If we go past all that, isn't though the final review, there's the significant discretion in the trial judge, and ultimately the issue for the trial judge and now for our review is whether indeed a jury was prejudiced. How do we overcome or step in the shoes of the judge who handled the trial, the pretrial, the post-trial, and did have a lengthy explanation for why ultimately the jury was not prejudiced? Is there something in particular in the record you would ask us to focus on that the judge was incorrect in that regard?
Well, you have several points, Your Honor. First, to analyze it as the plaintiff argued for an award that could have exceeded $5 million, it was only $1 million, therefore there's no prejudice. We don't know that. The jury wasn't polled or interviewed. We don't know what they thought. But if you look at, and this is my second point, Your Honor, if you look at the award for past pain and suffering and compare it to the future award on a per annum basis, it's significantly different. And that's where why we argued about it being prejudicial on the future damage award. There wasn't that much dispute about the past damages, but the future damage award for pain and suffering, for example, was much more significant than the past pain and suffering award. So I think right there you can see prejudice. And from the defendant's standpoint, when we argue for a zero award, and the award exceeds $1 million, that is evidence of prejudice by using the bully argument, misrepresenting what Dr. Bergarino believed, what I believed, and that I agreed with them on damages. And I don't know if I have any more time left. Again, I apologize for not being able to see, but.
Mr. Stempel, your time just expired a few seconds ago. I apologize that you weren't able to connect with video for the entire time, but I appreciate you participating by telephone. I'm just going to check and see if either of the panel members have additional questions for you. It doesn't appear that anyone does. So that will conclude the oral argument.